Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Great to see you all. And we don't have to hook all the wires up this morning because they're already hooked up. Actually, some of them we might say are wireless today. So that makes it a little easier. Well, greetings from the great state of North Carolina. We are in Asheville this morning. We had a good week, and we're a little bit ahead of schedule, and we're going to have to come up with an extra night of motel in Gatlinburg, and we're having trouble finding a room that was, under $180, and didn't want to have to move multiple times, so we ended up staying here in Asheville for two nights, and we'll go on to Gatlinburg. We're only a couple hours from there later this afternoon. But anyway, we got extended checkout this morning, so hopefully they won't kick us out before Sunday school's over. We can go along with our schedule here. We started reading Isaiah 26 last week, and I'm going to reread some of it just to renew our minds. It's always hard to start in the middle of a passage. And so I also realized that you perhaps haven't had an opportunity to revisit some of this stuff since last week, whereas I've been looking at it for hours, and so things are fresh on my mind that might not be on yours. So I want to just go ahead and read here from verse 1. In that day shall this song be sung in the land of Judah. We have a strong city. Salvation will God appoint for walls and bulwarks. Open ye the gates, that the righteous nation which keepeth the truth may enter in. Okay, so keep that idea in your mind. Open the gates. At the end of this poem, we'll have a bookend that suggests we close the gates or close the doors. So Isaiah is once again at work with his masterful poetry. So open the gates here, that the righteous nation that keepeth the truth is the King James here. You may remember last week we mentioned that some of the translations speak of faithfulness, the faithfulness of the righteous nation. And faithfulness is a huge concept in Isaiah's mind. And I say he's right on mark. When you think about what it is that mankind lacks with regard to his relationship to God, this is at the heart of it. What we by nature are faithful to is what we want, what we find desirable, what touches our fancy at the moment. And that changes constantly with our surroundings, with our age, with our circumstances, with our position in life. The things that were so desirable to us at an earlier stage no longer are. And the things which are desirable now will probably change in the future. And so faithfulness should be huge on our radar as what is important to God, our faithfulness to him. If we've lived very long, faithfulness already is huge on our radar with regard to our relationships with other people. It perhaps is more poignant in our mind with regard to their relationships to us. We highly value their faithfulness. And it is incumbent on us to realize that if the faithfulness of others to us is important to us, then it's very likely that our faithfulness to them is just as important to them. And so it's a quality that is not just to be admired in others, but to be pursued and emulated. And then, you know, what faithfulness breeds in relationship is trust. You trust those who have been faithful to you. And so that opens to us verse 3, thou will keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on thee, because he trusteth in thee. That beautiful verse that we talked at length about last week. Trust ye in the Lord forever, for in the Lord Jehovah is everlasting strength. For he bringeth down them that dwell on high, the lofty city. And you could substitute in your mind, if you wanted to make this passage current to our times, you could substitute any of the entities in our world which exalt themselves as being above, as being superior, as being celebrity, as being important, as being elite, of worthy of emulation or adoration. All the things which the average man looks around himself and looks at the world and says, you know, this is what is to be aspired to. This is where the power is. This is glory, if I could achieve that. Well, Isaiah looks at those things in his day, and he says, God bringeth them down that dwell on high. He layeth it low, even to the ground. He bringeth it even to the dust. The foot shall tread it down, even the most lowly of the feet of the poor, the steps of the needy. The way of the just is uprightness. Thou, most upright, dost weigh the path of the just. Now, this is one of those verses in Isaiah that it benefits from looking at another translation. And we did look at this briefly last week, but just to remind you that the ESV translates this, the path of the righteous is level. You make level the path or the way of the righteous. And keeping in mind righteous, just, looking for justice, God's justice in the world. Perhaps the first impression from that we looked at last week was the idea that God prepares the way of the just. And yet you do have to recognize that there's no claim that trying to live a righteous life means your path's going to be smooth. Isaiah wouldn't claim that either. And perhaps we should take this more in the sense of, as opposed to walking a path which is full of turns to the left or to the right, or full of heights and lows and valleys and mountains, the man who walks in the justice of God is seeking a path, is following a path which has the constancy that faithfulness and trust bring. I don't think there's any doubt that God does aid the righteous, those that seek his justice. But at the same time, there are the normal pitfalls of life that face all of us. And so there's not a claim here that God makes it perfect, easy sailing all the time. But I think we can see that sense that those who are pursuing a faithfulness to God's justice are looking for the path, which is level, and not going in one direction or another that is off that constancy that he represents. Now, I don't have all of the normal communication cues that I do when I'm there in person. So if you would like to comment or question at any point, you may need to make a little more racket than normal, because I think when I'm speaking, it actually mutes your speaker temporarily. So I can see Laura and Micah and some of those are there in the middle. And so if you hear somebody talking and I'm not responding, start waving your hand and I'll stop. Okay. But if you don't, I won't.
We got that.
Okay. Next verse. Yea, in the way of thy judgments, O Lord, have we waited for thee. The desire of our soul is to thy name and to the remembrance of thee. This verse really communicates to me. I don't know if it's something that just comes with age. I know when you are young, you have lots of ambitions, and I still have ambitions, but at the same time, at the end of the day, when I sit down to reflect on what is valuable and what is true, I can so identify with what Isaiah is saying here. A desire to see God work, his work in time, in our world, to bring about his will on all the universe, on our immediate surroundings and our immediate time. I'm not looking for some great charismatic person, some politician, some leader, some celebrity to make our world right, to bring about a transformation, reverse all of our problems. My only hope is in the justice of God. But the desire of my soul is for his will and his way to prevail in the world. And so I say yea, I say yes to Isaiah here in his expression of this thought. With my soul have I desired thee in the night. Yea, with my spirit within me will I seek thee early. For when thy judgments, thy justice is in the earth, the inhabitants of the world will learn what is right. Righteousness. I remember this verse last week. We talked about verse 10. Let favor be showed to the wicked, yet will he not learn righteousness? In the very land of uprightness will he deal unjustly and will not behold the majesty of the Lord. Okay, and I think this captures a very accurate snapshot of man's wayward nature. When we are bent on doing what we want, any pleasant thing that we encounter along the way is just a stepping stone to help us toward the end that we're working for. We don't look at the blessings of God as things that would cause us to stop and consider his goodness, but it's just like taken for granted. We don't learn from the goodness that is given us when we are totally possessed with achieving what we want. In the very land of uprightness, we're still working to achieve our goals and our ends. And so Isaiah has really pegged our nature there. He terms it the wicked, but we don't want to ever forget that we're not born righteous. It's hard for us at times to look in the face of a lovely newborn human being and see anything but goodness. And there's a certain beauty in the innocence that we see there. But at the same time, we don't want to ever forget that we are looking in the face of a will which is in bondage to self-pleasure, a will which is ignorant of the goodness of God, and a will which one day is capable of any evil that's ever been committed on earth. And it is only whenever that will is arrested and surrendered, submitted to the goodness of God, that we can rightfully classify a human being as anything but wicked. That sounds hard. But if you've lived very long, you see it play out over and over again. We're pretty good when we get what we want.
When we get what we want.
So he says, let favor be showed to the wicked. He will not learn righteousness from the goodness given him. The implication in my mind is, until there's a change of heart, the goodness doesn't benefit him. Lord, when thy hand is lifted up, they will not see, but they shall see and be ashamed for their envy at the people. Yea, the fire of thine enemies shall devour them. Okay, this is one of those verses which have some alternative translations. The complete Jewish Bible says, Adonai, you raised your hand, but they still didn't see. Okay, so we've seen in Isaiah this image of God with a raised hand, an outstretched hand, and seen that as a symbol of his acting, usually in wrath, but at any rate, his acting. And so, excuse me, Isaiah says, they don't see that. Yet with shame, they will see your zeal for the people. Yes, fire will destroy your enemies. So if you compare that to the King James, considerably different in some aspects. Rather than the fire of thine enemies devouring them, it is fire will destroy your enemies. And the envy is not their envy at the people, but the zeal of God for the people. They shall be ashamed. So the point overall isn't lost in either case. They don't see what God's doing, but they will see, and they will be ashamed because of it. But sometimes if you find yourself stumbling over certain words and not feeling like you grasp the picture, it's good to look at another translation. Verse 12, Lord, thou wilt ordain peace for us. Okay, ordain means to place, to put in place. Thou will ordain peace for us. For thou also hast wrought all our works in us. Okay, so in that verse, you sort of wonder if that is in meaning sort of connected to that passage in the Psalms where God talks about having wrought us, have formed us, this idea of our works in us. Here again, another translation perhaps illuminates it a little better. Once again, to the complete Jewish Bible. Adonai, you will grant us peace because all we have done, you have done for us. Okay, so wrought all our works in us is understood to mean you have done them for us. Verse 13, O Lord our God, other lords besides thee have had dominion over us, but by thee only will we make mention of thy name. They are dead, they shall not live. They are deceased, they shall not rise. Therefore hast thou visited and destroyed them and made all their memory to perish. Okay, so that's the King James of that. It's interesting sometimes how different the Septuagint. The Septuagint, of course, to be repetitious, is that Greek translation of the Old Testament, which most of the New Testament writers quote. So by the time of Jesus, Greek had become such a universal language in the world that the Jews of Palestine were using, quoting the Septuagint based on what we have in the New Testament. And so this translation of the ancient Hebrew sometimes is a little different. In this passage, this is 13, O Lord our God, take possession of us. O Lord, we know not any other besides thee. We name thy name. So it doesn't at all have that image of other lords having dominion over us. It's understood as a prayer for God to have dominion over us. And that by thee only, or that is, we name thy name. Okay. Scroll down here.
Can you sound a little thick? Can you hear me?
Laura's a little thick. Yes. Can you hear her?
Yes.
Just at this moment, I will clarify. The Septuagint, I know you said that in New Testament times, it was quoted, the Old Testament was quoted through the Septuagint. That was the version they probably read in Greek.
Yes.
But what we're reading, so the King James translation was also from that?
No. The King James did have the translators had the Hebrew at their disposal and predominantly follow it.
So then when we're looking at the Greek Jewish Bible, that's more the Septuagint?
No, that'd be Hebrew.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, most modern translators have preferred to go to what's understood to be an older version, the Hebrew, to do the translation. It's interesting, this this transition started during the time of Augustine. St. Jerome was translating the whole Bible into Latin. And there was discussions about, well, at that time they had access to both the ancient Hebrew and the Greek Septuagint, but most of the church had been raised with the Greek Septuagint. And so there was discussion about, well, should I use the ancient Hebrew or should I go with what we're used to? And Augustine had argued against using the ancient Hebrew because it wasn't familiar to him. They should stick with the more familiar Septuagint. So by this point in time, of course, in our day, we're long past it until most people don't even know what you're talking about when you talk about the Septuagint. Yes?
Original Hebrew, why is it so different? Because of the lack of vowels and the freedom to...
Okay, so yeah, it would be the fact that Hebrew is difficult to translate. And so in general, you'll find that the CJB will be similar to NAS, ESV, some of the newer translations that have the benefit of later scholarship. It's just I often quote the CJB because I like its language. You know, it has some of the beauty comparable to the King James, as well as a Jewish perspective. And so you'll find that I quote it a lot, but you'll almost always, if you would look at NAS or ESV, you're going to find a similar translation. In fact, for my part, if I see that's not the case, I'll probably mention it rather than just refer to it as having authority on its own. Okay, so that was verse 14, wasn't it? Thou hast increased the nation, O Lord. Thou hast increased the nation. Thou art glorified. Okay, so we have this picture up here. Give us peace. Everything that has been done, you have done for us. Take possession of us. We look to thee alone. You have been the one to increase the nation. You have increased the nation. You are glorified. Thou hast removed it far unto all the ends of the earth. Okay, so this is a picture of the righteous nation expanding to occupy the whole earth with God's doing. Lord, in trouble have they visited thee. They poured out a prayer when thy chastening was upon them. Okay, so... Now Isaiah is reflecting on the way people do to God, right? So there's always lots of religion in certain times and places among men. You've heard that saying, perhaps you'll never find an atheist in a foxhole. Whenever things are really rough, whenever you're at the end of your means, it's real easy to say, oh, God, help me, right? Help me now. I need you. And, you know, if we would look at ourselves at a distance and say, you know, that really is little of us to ignore him in the midst of all the blessings of life. But whenever we're in a tight spot, suddenly he's important. He's all glorious. He's all powerful and he needs to share a little bit of it with us. And so that's what Isaiah says, in trouble have they visited thee, poured out a prayer when thy chastening was upon them. That's the way we do. He says, like as a woman with child that draweth near the time of her delivery is in pain and crieth out in her pangs, so have we been in thy sight, O Lord. We have been with child. We have been in pain. We have, as it were, brought forth wind. We have not brought any deliverance in the earth, neither have the inhabitants of the world fallen. Okay, so there's some of the details of that metaphor that we want to look at in another translation, but in general, the picture here is quite clear. He likens our interest in God and what he can do for us with the traumatic experience of childbirth. And of course, I'm well aware that those of us that are not bearing people, or whatever the current term is, birthing people, that's it. Those of us who are not birthing people never experienced that firsthand. But we're well aware of the metaphor nevertheless, and can identify at a distance with the trauma. Apparently associated with it is often a very inescapable feeling. You know, this is upon me. There's no way out of it but through it. And so here it is. And yet he says, we've brought forth wind. That's what we give birth to. And there's a certain irony here. It was the breath, the wind of God, that brought life to man to start with. The form of man, the body of man, didn't have life when God formed it. He breathed into it the breath of life. And so there is this sense that wind, breath, is the very essence of life. And yet, if you don't have a body, you don't have anything either. And so if you just have wind, that is of no account. It just comes and goes, and where did it go and where did it come from? It's of no substance, unless it's at a very high velocity and they don't lock you over. But nevertheless, it doesn't compare to the vitality and the incredible reality of birth, the birth of a living being. And so this verse 18, the last part of it, neither have the inhabitants of the world fallen. And you're like, okay, so what's that about? That seems to be on a little different page. Well, if we look at some other translations, CJB, for instance, they go like this: we have been pregnant and been in pain, but we, as it were, have given birth to wind. We have not brought salvation to the land. And those inhabiting the world have not come to life. And so some translators have understood this fallen, not as a fallen to destruction, but as in real life, there's a sense in which the newborn falls out, drops. Have just seen it as a way of communicating a birth. So we have brought forth wind. We haven't brought forth life to the inhabitants of the world. We haven't given birth to anything of bodily substance. So that's kind of an interesting alternative translation there. And then the Septuagint, wow, goes in a really different direction. We have conceived, O Lord, because of thy fear, and have been brought in pain. I'm sorry, and have been in pain, and have brought forth the breath of thy salvation, which we have wrought upon the earth. We shall not fall, but all that dwell upon the land shall fall. So the translators there understood the verse to be talking about bringing God's salvation to the world because of our fear of him. So that goes in a very different direction, doesn't it? Perhaps you would see the Septuagint version as even being a sort of a messianic passage. As far as I know, it's not one the New Testament writers used, referred to, so I'm not sure how they understood it. But either way, it does communicate a valid message. Certainly in the Hebrew version here, we can see that compared to God, we have not brought forth life to the world. Rather, it is as though we have brought forth wind and it is already gone. I'm reminded when I read this passage of Isaiah using birth pangs as a metaphor of a passage in the New Testament. In Matthew 24:8, Jesus refers to the troubles that are coming upon the world as all these are but the beginning of the birth pains. So this was a common metaphor in the minds of biblical reading folks. I might just mention here, you know, the whole process of reading the Bible and coming away with increased understanding is a challenge. It's a life challenge. And in history, we have seen such a variety of behaviors, of conclusions, of proclamations that have been based on what is considered by the people doing them as a biblical foundation. This really is a difficult thing to look at, and at times perplexing. For me personally, I think that the safest place to be is to labor to be faithful to the apparent, if we can find it, the apparent intentions of the author. What is it the author wants us to get from this? And not go down a line of how creative can I be here? How can I come up with something that maybe somebody else hasn't thought of? For my part, I'm not looking for originality here. I'm wanting to be faithful to the intention of the writer. Because I believe that in these words, we have a communication of truth that is worthy to be lived by. And so I don't have to twist it, and I don't have to be creative with it. I had an experience this week with two different Amish gentlemen that sort of brought this to mind. So we sell and buy from the Amish, and some wonderful people. In general, they live a very different lifestyle than we do, but there's a huge variety too amongst them of their interpretation of what is biblical and what is the right way to live. So, my first experience was with a very successful Amish man that has he's very up on politics. He knows what's going on. He knows how to make money. And he has a cell phone, believe it or not. Now, some of the Amish, they can only have a phone that's out in a little house down by the road or away from their house or whatever. And some of them are allowed to have it in their business. But he has a cell phone in his pocket. And that's, I think, only been in recent years that's developed. But we came into his place just before closing, and I was most interested in getting in and out in a hurry so we didn't delay him. But if you get him talking about politics, time really doesn't matter. He's happy to to take some time. And in the course of the conversation, somehow, I don't know if Rachel mentioned something funny she had seen about politics, but suddenly he had his phone out and he wanted to show us all these political jokes that his right-wing friend had sent him. And I'm standing here, this is surreal. Here's an Amish guy thumbing through the pictures on his phone, showing me these political jokes. And he comes, some of them had references to movies and different things. He says, I don't know what that means. And he go to the next one. I don't know what that one means either. So half of them he didn't get, but he was just really wanting us to enjoy some of these. And I was worried about getting out of there and not taking his time. So it was a very surreal moment for me. He's a unique individual. Anyway, a little later, I guess it was the next day, we were at a much more conservative Amish gentleman's establishment. And I don't even know how the topic of cell phones came up. I know what it was. Rachel was doing taxes for some of his friends in the community, and I was checking on where she was so we'd know when she got back. He said, oh, wow, you know where she is? Yeah, I do. And so, you know, we talked about how this, you know, was an incredible tool potentially. But I was quick to say, you know, on the other hand, this is not just something you open yourself up to. This is not something you hand your kids and say, here, go have a good time. You know, this is a gateway to the world. And I sometimes forget all the things that are in place in my own mind when I use one, so that I'm able to avoid stuff which is objectionable. But, you know, even the Bible program on my phone has advertisements on it that I'm not interested in seeing. It is potentially a very dangerous thing for the unguarded. In this conversation, and he said, a guy was telling me the other day, he said, you know, in the Bible where it talks about Jesus being tempted by the devil, and the devil showed him all the world, all the kingdoms of the world. He said, I had a guy tell me that, well, that's the cell phone. You can see it right there, all right before you. And I was thinking about that. And basically in his mind, that of course reinforced his idea that you shouldn't have one, or at least that he shouldn't have one. But that kind of level of thinking where you find some passage in the Bible, which you can in some way find a similarity to something in your mind, and you say, oh yeah, that's what's going on there. And of course the logic doesn't work anyway, because just the fact that the devil showed him all the kingdoms of the world, there's no particular sin there. There's no prohibition there. They're there to be seen. And so how you would extract from that any sort of commandment about what to do is a little bit difficult. I suppose it's sort of guilt by association. If the devil's showing you this, it must not be any good. But to use the Bible in that way is going to be a very dangerous path to try to follow, because anybody that's particularly adept at being creative and making new and creative connections is going to be able to manipulate your life. The point of the temptations is that you do the will of God and you don't do the will of anybody else, even if it has apparently great rewards for you, including the whole world. And so it's not hard to figure out a pretty straightforward understanding of what the passage illustrates for us. Of course, it illustrates the fact that Jesus didn't give in to the devil or anything else. But to take and decide that this, in fact, is talking about cell phones and gives me guidance on whether I should have one or not, is going to be a very difficult path to live if you try to be governing your life in that way. On the other hand, I would say to the Amish, you know what? You're getting along fine without them. You don't need them. There's no need to follow every new thing. Our life would be, as it currently is, would be impossible without one, in terms of motel reservations and directions and all those things. Now we could change our life and make it different and simpler, whatever. It's not a fundamental question of how you must live life. And so you want to be very careful what you do with Scripture. And so I just want to say up front that my approach is to be as faithful as I can to the intention of the writer. I've got nothing unique to say, and I have nothing to prove. I just want the truth. And so that's been the best way to live I found in my life. So Isaiah here compares what we accomplish with our efforts to the bringing forth of wind. And then in the last couple minutes we have here, we have an extraordinary verse in Old Testament terms. Verse 19, he says, "Thy dead men shall live. Together with my dead body shall they arise. Awake and sing, ye that dwell in dust. For thy dew is as the dew of herbs, and the earth shall cast out the dead." Okay, so it has often been loudly proclaimed that resurrection of the dead is hard to find in the Old Testament. And in terms of number of verses, that is true. But we've already noted in chapter 25 that there is this consciousness of a time when God will bring about a victory over death. In Isaiah 25:8, you remember he says he will swallow up death in victory. And the Lord God will wipe away tears from off all faces, and the rebuke of his people shall he take away from off all the earth, for the Lord hath spoken it. And here again, we see him revisiting this resurrection topic. In closing here, a passage from Alec Motyer and his commentary about this. He says, "In sum, therefore, the verse is a promise of life for the world, the fulfillment of chapter 25, which I just read to you. But if this is so, we need to recall that 25, 7 through 8 looked forward to the abolition of death itself. In this regard, the terms of the present verse go beyond the figurative to the literal and declare a full resurrection, including the resurrection of the body. Okay? My dead body shall arise, it says here in Isaiah 19. Within the progressive revelation of the Old Testament, only Daniel 12:2 is comparable. And Daniel 12:2 says, "And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt." He now comments on the current scholarship. The reigning hypothesis dates Daniel in the 2nd century BC. And this, coupled with the continuing supposition that Old Testament doctrine is subject to an evolutionary development from poor beginnings to brilliant endings, has led some to propose a very late date for verse 19. Okay, so some scholars, when they read Isaiah, have denied that it was composed in its whole as a single composition, but was compiled from different times and places. And so a passage like this that speaks of resurrection from the dead, they say, oh, that's very late, because we don't see anything like that until the time of Daniel, and that was 2nd century BC, which is, again, disputable. And so they would propose a late date for that verse. Alex says how insubstantial this is. So now he reflects on history. He says, the Egyptians had an intricate and highly developed mythology of the dead and the life to come centuries before Isaiah. Even Canaanite religion, with all its brutishness, ascribed to its executive god an annual victory over death. We are expected, however, to accept that Israel's emphasis on Yahweh as the living God, we are expected to put the shadowy realm of the dead outside his jurisdiction. In the name of all logic, how could this be so? Okay, so in his muted way, that's about as close as he comes to shouting. He says, this is absurd. This is ridiculous to when you look at the fact that these other nations around Israel had a very vibrant notion of life after death in some form or another, even though it's not what we consider to be true. The idea that Israel had no conception to all of this, he says, is illogical. And so there's no need to put this verse in another, in the realm of another author many years later, because it is appropriate here. And it is, if you look at the structure of the composition, it belongs here. And, is a part of a whole Isaianic composition and not a chopped up thingamajigger that's put together much later. And so at the end of this, we had a closing, come my people, enter into thy chambers. We started out with an open the gates, shut thy doors about thee, hide thyself as it were for a little while until the indignation be passed, overpassed. For behold, the Lord cometh out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. The earth also shall disclose her blood and shall no longer cover her slain. Sorry, I went a few minutes over there, but I will stop today and see you all soon. Thank you.